Right. Well, let's start by asking you to give us your name, and go on to describe how you came to work in the grain industry.
My name is Janice Andrews, and I initially had my parents' friends actually worked in the grain industry. He was a grain inspector way back. He was one of the, I don't know how long he'd been on the job already, but he was probably in his 50s when I started. So he gave me a recommendation. He told me when they were hiring, and I put in my application. This was in 1978. And I waited until they called me. I didn't make the first list.
Commission was beginning to employ women in those years.
Exactly.
So you weren't part of the first group.
No, I wasn't the first group. I was probably, when I was on, there may have been, I'm just counting in my head, 3, 4, 5 or 6 women on already.
So you were recommended, in a sense, by a male grade inspector.
Yes, who was a family friend.
But. Right, and did he have any comment on the fact that he was recommending you as a woman to become a...
No, because he was in the environment now where there were women,
yeah.
So he thought I would be a good addition to the other women that were there.
And he was still employed, of course.
He was still employed,
so he was inviting you really to join part of the commission's workforce.
Exactly, good. Yeah. So I think I was 67th on the list when I first applied.
In the seniority list.
Yeah.
So that would be a local seniority list, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And worked your way up.
And worked my way up.
So that's in 1978.
So I that's when I first applied, and I didn't get actually on the job until 1979, in the fall.
And the expected period of employment for a grain inspector was?
An assistant grain inspector. That's how you came on.
Yeah.
And usually because the season ends in December, the shipping season. So we were called casual employees or term employees. The government, we change terms.
Yes.
So I was usually on until the end of the shipping season. So I got hired in September, end of August, and I worked right up until first week of December, second week of December.
Basically through the fall of 1979 then.
Exactly.
And then you were called back earlier in the year the next time, I suppose.
It was around April. So when the shipping season opens, that's when they need extra people.
Yeah. And you were with the commission until...
I'm still working.
Oh, you're still working.
Another 18 more days.
18 days.
18 working days, actually.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm retiring in January.
Right, so it's the end of the season.
The
09 season will be the end of it. So it's going to be 30 years and a little bit more.
Yeah.
Well, and you worked through all of this period for the Canadian Grain Commission.
That I did, yes.
And I guess what kind of work you did would take us into the stages of your career. So you started as an assistant
grain inspector. So we were actually... Back then, there was no automation, so to speak. So we basically did what we called manual sampling.
Right. You might describe a typical day, I suppose, at that stage of your career.
So the manual sampling, basically on the deck of a boat. So you would go out there and you had it was a long piece of metal with a bucket, what we called a scoop. Well, it was a scoop on the end that was welded onto the end, sort of like a cup.
Right.
And then you went out with this scoop and you took grain samples from the stream of grain as it flowed from the big pipes in the elevator into the hold of the ship. And there was a real art to it, of course.
I dare say.
So you had to time it so that you wouldn't get whacked in the, with the stick on your elbow and everything else. And
a good deal of force to await a grain falling.
Exactly. And then, when you're up on the deck of a boat and you look into those big holds, if it's an empty boat, you're looking down, I don't even know how many feet it is. 50.
Far enough.
Yeah, long way if you were to fall.
Yes.
So and there's just little railings around there. It probably was not the safest environment to be in at that time, but actually liked, I like being outside. I like doing the physical part of it. We had to carry bags. We had to carry all the equipment up.
You take a sample and then into a bag, I suppose?
Yeah.
And then?
There was actually a method to the sampling. You just didn't stick out the scoop and grab grain and then throw it into a bag because the grain would go in what we call drafts. So one draft would be 50 tons, say. So it would shoot 50 tons of grain out, and then it would stop. And then they weigh up another 50 tons, and then it would shoot out. So for each draft that would come, you would do probably 6 scoops. The middle, the 2 sides, the back.
Right.
And you basically had a rhythm how you did it. And you would do it exactly the same for each draft.
Right. And the samples, the 6 samples from one draft would all go into a bag together?
Yep.
Or would you?
Yeah.
You weren't concerned about keeping them separate?
No. The only thing.
But you did want to keep the samples from each draft.
Each hold. So one pipe would go into one hold.
Yes.
And then you might have another pipe with another type of grain going into another hold.
Right.
So then you would keep those buckets separate. So you would, the inspector would actually tell you when they needed the grain. So he would say at 500 ton, he would want a sample. So then you had to count the drafts, so you knew when each draft was 50 ton.
Yes.
And then you actually every draft, you would put all the grain into a bucket, and then once you hit the 500 ton, you would mix it all up and then pour it into a bag. And then you always kept your surplus in a separate bag, just in case something happened.
The surplus being?
Whatever didn't fit into the bag.
Okay.
And then you put it into like a big, we had big cargo bags that were burlap sacks.
Yes.
And it would go in there. That would be your extra.
Right.
In case the bag broke on the way to the office.
Okay.
And then.
And you'd remain the custodian of the surplus?
Yes.
And each of them had to be labeled, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Too. We had little tickets that we'd take up. They were little pieces of paper that you'd write on, and you had to put what hold you were in and how many tons.
Yeah.
And the type of grain that was going in there. And you took that piece of paper and stuck it in the bag.
In the top of the bag.
Tied it up with a string. It was a white cotton bag. It would be about this big.
Right.
Tied it up. You know, you can't see that on the interview. It's about 12 inches by 8 inches. And you tie it up. And then you would, someone inside the office would also know when it was 500 ton because they're talking to the weigh person. So they would come out, stand on the dock, and yell up at you. And then I would heave the bag over the side.
Ooh, that sounds like fun.
And they would catch it down there. So that's why you always kept more in
this
case.
This is where the breakage could occur.
That's right. Yeah, so that's why you always kept a little bit extra. Yeah.
Okay. How long would it take to reach the 510 point, one bag complete?
It depends on the elevator. It depends because some elevators load faster. They might have 2 pipes going into that one hole. So each of them would be running 50 ton drafts. So then you would.
And would you try to sample both
sheets
in that case?
You have to sample both. Yeah.
Become a bit lively at that point.
Yeah.
Because I suppose a 50 ton drop would. How long would that take?
That depended on the elevator too. If it was a big like pool, the old SAS pool 7A.
Yes.
The new name is Viterra.
Yes.
I still call it the old name 7A.
Why not?
It would. It's a very big elevator, it's very fast, so they would run faster, just because the belts were bigger and everything like that. If you went to a small elevator, like Manitoba Pool 1 or Pool 3, the old Pool 3, they would be smaller, takes a little bit slower, so yeah. But if you had, at 7A, you always had 2 people on the deck of the boat also, so it wasn't just one person.
Yeah. Took 2 to keep up with.
Oh, yeah, because you might have 2 pipes here loading a specific type of grain, and way down on the other end, like another pipe with another type of grain. So there's no way you could physically go back and forth.
So many tons would you handle in a day? I guess that's another way. 8-hour days, 12-hour days?
Eight. Seven and a half, and then half hour overtime.
Right. And how many tons might you handle in a day?
They could load. 7A, again, it's a bigger elevator, so they're usually, my figures are probably going to be off a bit, but they would load probably about 2,000 ton an hour. So in 10 hours.
So 500 would be 15 minutes or so to break it down.
Yeah. So
six samples in.
They could do a whole boatload in a day.
No, more samples than that, because you're doing six samples per 50. So this is 10, so this is 60 per 15 minutes?
Sometimes.
It's pretty lively.
Well, usually after the first 500 ton, then they would get it every 1,000, depending on the order. If it's a small order, then you have more bags. If it's a larger order, then if it's 21,000 ton and it's all the same grain, then you space it out a little bit more.
And so that's what the assistant inspector would do. And how long did you do that?
As an assistant inspector? It was maybe about 4 years. As an assistant.
So you spent four years on the decks of ships at Thunder Bay, at all the various elevators.
Yeah. That'd be it was fun.
Kind of fun in its way, yes.
We not only on the decks of boats, but we were also inside the car sheds where the actual rail cars came in and unloaded.
Yes.
So when I started, that wasn't automated either. So you had to actually physically go to a sampler that would be running in the elevator, and all the grain would go into a bucket. That part was automated, and then we would take the grain out of the bucket and bring it into the office.
Right.
So eventually everything got automated, so we're no longer on the deck of the boats, and we no longer work in the car sheds.
The assistant inspector, in a sense, has been phased out, at least this kind of function, replaced by machinery.
Exactly. Yeah. However, with that gone, now we have, it's more automated in our offices now, so there's more computer. Every station has a computer. For the loading of vessels now, you have a board. Everything's automated, so you can actually see the grain running and how many tons. You can tell to the point, three decimal points, how much grain is run. So it's taken a lot of guesswork out of it.
Right. Now, the move from assistant inspector to what? Simply inspector?
Yep.
Would involve training proficiencies of various sorts you had to acquire?
Yeah, it was because in the old days, if you were brand new, you only were relegated to certain jobs, which were basically on the deck of a boat and everything.
It involved some skill, but it's basically kind of tedious in its way in terms of just gathering the samples.
Exactly, and that was when I was a casual. Once you became full-time on as an assistant inspector, that was another, you had to compete for that. It's a competition. So once you became full-time, then you were given training in a year. So you're given a year of training, and then you had to pass what they call a barrier exam to prove that you've absorbed all the knowledge in that year, and now you can be a fully qualified grain assistant, which did more. Then we did more jobs than just going on the boat. So now you could...
What was the knowledge that you were expected to know?
We have what we call a grain grading guide, the official grain grading guide. So that was like our Bible, and it had everything in it for every single type of grain that the Grain Commission was responsible for. So there's tolerances for foreign material that you can have in a sample of grain. Moisture tests, percentages, all kinds of definitions that you had to know, like what is other material, what is dockage, what are stones in a sample, that kind of thing. And we had to memorize everything. Back then, we didn't have the luxury of open books or anything like that, like they do now.
Really? So you're a sort of a superior kind of inspector in terms of what?
Well, I hate to say it, but all our senior people, we kind of, give it to the new people now, because we had to, not only walk to school both ways uphill, but we had to memorize everything. And it was a lot of... it was a lot of memorization.
Yes.
Yeah, we would actually start studying 6 months before we knew the deadline was. Yeah, yeah. It kept you sharp, though. It really kept you on the ball and interested.
So I guess we think of wheat, I suppose, as the most valuable grain.
Mm-hmm.
How many different grades of wheat were there?
Different grades? Well, there's seven different types of wheat.
Okay.
So we had to know all of those. So they all
mainly,
look. There's Durham wheat, there's Red Spring wheat, there's Canada Prairie Spring wheat, red and white, there's soft white spring wheat, and red winter wheat, and we used to call it utility, it's extra strong, they call it now. So there was all that, we had to be able to recognize them visually, and then
because
also
that was part of the plant breeding program in Canada, wasn't it?
Exactly.
It still is, I guess, although I'm told it's under threat. but this visual distinguishability of the varieties.
Exactly, and that was the big, especially with the wheat, that was the big thing, that the big requirement, the criteria was they had to be visually distinguishable.
Yeah.
Each class had to be visually distinguished, and now they've done away with that. And you can, I really notice it now that it's getting harder to tell the classes apart.
Yes.
You know, so, and that's a skill that we're losing.
Yes.
Which is very sad. Yeah.
Well, we'd better not go on about that at any length. At this point in the interview, at least, tempting as it is. I suppose other grains, barley, there wouldn't be as many kinds.
There's actually two different classes of barley, so you have a 6-row and a 2-row. And maltsters use the different classes for different types of recipes, I guess, for their beer. Different tastes, different brewing properties and all that. So those, and then there's also the feed barley where you can just grow any kind of variety and basically it goes to feed. So we had to know all of that also.
And oats?
Oats, yeah. There's oats are just oats.
Oats
basically.
Is oats.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I first started, and I just vaguely remember this because I wasn't a grain inspector when this was going on, but we used to have like a horse class of oat, which was...
feed.
It was the premier oat.
Oh, was it?
It was for racehorses.
Oh, yeah.
So it was the premier, beautiful oat that would be segregated in. But they didn't do that for very long, I don't know.
No.
Now it's just all feed, basically, and Quaker Oats, of course, is a big buyer.
And
Quaker Oats.
Quaker Oats, the cereal.
And the cereals, yeah.
Yes. And then we have flax.
Flax, which... when I first started, it wasn't all of a big deal because it was more industrial.
Sure.
Way back, it was the industrial
oil. So,
yeah, the linseed oil and all that. And then the big health thing came out. And so now it became more prominent, more desirable. So the flax production went up, of course.
But as far as grain is concerned, or whatever, flax is flax, I suppose.
Yeah, flax is flax, yeah. And the same with canola.
Oh, right,
canola is canola. And pretty much all the other grains, they are whatever they are. Wheat is your big class where you have to know more things.
So you learned all those things and you passed the test and you were now a permanent assistant
grain inspector. And then to become a grain inspector, there was another competition.
Yes.
So then you had to apply yourself again. The level was a little bit more... detailed, because now you're actually grading the grain. So as an assistant, you're not really grading the grain, but as an inspector, you are.
Yes.
So then you had to know, again, more memorization, and knowing when you're looking at grain, what does it qualify?
In the grading of grain, foreign matter is a part of that, I guess, is it?
Mm-hmm.
You want to take us into... the fine points of adulteration of a fine seed?
Well,
speaking as a farmer's son who has, I'm sure, hauled many a bushel of adulterated grain.
Well, now, of course, with the combines
and
the amount that they can clean before it even gets to the primary elevator, we're not seeing as much what we call dockage material.
So the wheat seeds particularly, I guess.
So anything that can be removed from the grain... is called dockage. So it can and has to be removed before we put a grain on it. So that's all dockage material, which the elevator regurgitates as pellets and mixed feed oats. So nothing
makes it into a byproduct in a sense.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes.
So they don't waste anything in the elevator. And then what we're left with is the main sample of, say, wheat. And then if anything is still remaining in the wheat, then that's called foreign material. And then there's tolerances for that. So in a number one grade, you could only have, say, 0.4 of a percentage of, say, barley in a wheat sample.
Sure.
Or oats. Wheat sample.
Yeah, that too is, I suppose, a more or less honorable kind of dockage to have when there's seeds of other grains.
Yep. It depends because of the end use of the product, too. So that's how they determine what the percentages are of foreign material. And you can also have different wheats mixed together too.
Sure.
So that's another thing we're on the lookout for, is because you can't mix, you don't want to mix Durham in with your Red Spring because no. they're so opposite.
Quite different purposes.
Yeah.
It is. And, did that happen very often?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Would it happen because of elevators, because of this mixture out of bins that somehow got?
Sometimes, yeah, especially going onto a boat,
yes.
going onto the vessel, that's where you'd see mixes like that because maybe a bin was misrepresented or, you know, like we don't have any control over what happens, what the elevator does with the grain. We just basically just say report the news.
Yeah, you're assessing what's actually happened.
Right. So what they do with the grain is their business. So.
I suppose there you have had experiences of pulling and saying, like, God, what's happened here? Or rather, how did that happen?
Exactly.
Because you could tell at a glance what has actually happened, I guess,
yeah.
in some of these cases.
And you can, as soon as you see something that's amiss, then you immediately, if you're loading a vessel, of course, you immediately tell the elevator.
And do they then stop the loading process?
They have a choice. They can.
Depending on the customer, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess it's all their logistics to them.
Yeah.
You know, if they can find it or shut it down or whatever. In most cases, they will, of course.
Yes. So Durham, for example, would not be easily cleaned or removed from a, say, spring wheat.
No, absolutely. Almost impossible.
So you'd have to sell it as a mixture.
Exactly. Yeah, a mixed grain. And then that's when you get other political entities involved. You get the wheat
yes.
board involved because they're representing the customer. They're
yes.
they're the buyer and seller. So
yes.
they're representing the customer. They'll do the talking. And like I said, we just report the news, basically.
Yes. So becoming a grain inspector, and that was the ultimate step achieved at what point in your career? Or are there further
no.
steps?
Well, the grain inspector, what we would call a PI3, that would be the grain inspector. Mostly we would do the inward cars that came in. So the unloads, that would be our basic duty, would be grading those cars that came in.
Mm-hmm.
On occasion we would do the vessels. But the vessels were basically the realm of the supervisor, the acting, or the, not the acting, the PI4, actually.
Oh, so this is,
there is another
it
level.
Reads up,
yes.
1, 2, 3, 4,
exactly.
The larger the number, the higher you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the highest?
Let's see, my boss is a 7,
okay.
a PI7.
The seniority part of that, or is it primarily skill levels?
Because there's no seniority when we compete, so that was taken out. So you're basically on an even playing field with anyone who
okay.
competes.
So it is a measure of knowledge, of skill, and so on
yeah.
and so forth at that point.
It's
right?
Basically.
And the higher level is closer to the customer, I suppose, then in the sense of, you know, the ones who are involved with a ship as against coming
yeah.
in and from the cars.
In his case, yes. In the PI7's case, because he is actually, he supervises all the PI4s, so all the, and he's basically responsible for all the shipments that go out. He gives his okay
yes.
to that. And the level that I obtained, my final level, is a PI5, and I'm the trainee and the regional trainer. So my job right now and for the last 20 years was training grain inspectors in how to grade grain.
I see.
Finer points.
Right. Oh, so you were the right one to press on the distinctions among these various varieties and so on and so
yeah.
forth.
Yeah.
How long does it take to train an assistant to be ready? You're training them for the various
stages.
Levels,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So brand new off the street right now to be able to pass their barrier and to be a fully qualified
permanent
assistant PI1, we are looking at between 6 and 8 months. And now we're much more flexible because now we do it according to the person. Whereas before it was, you've had this length of time, either you pass it or you don't, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's related to the person and then how they learn. And
developing their skill level.
Yeah, exactly.
Why was the change made? How did the flexibility come in?
I'm not really sure how it happened. I guess it was just, you know, 21st century, we should.
Oh, it's that recent, actually.
Yeah, it is, actually, yeah.
Right.
It is that
yeah.
recent, yeah. There was quite a while where in Thunder Bay we were pretty stagnant as far as hiring and stuff, so we didn't we didn't really pursue any new ways of doing things.
No, because you became permanent staff, was it 83?
Actually, I passed my PI1 barrier because when I came on, I was casual, so I was just seasonal, I guess they would call it. And then when I came on full-time, and that was another level, still a PI1, assistant grade inspector. And then I became what they call seasonal full-time. And that was in 80, the end of 1980. So actually, it happened pretty fast for me. Okay. Some people could be casual and just called back seasonally for 10 years, you know.
Is a reflection of ability and capacity?
No, a lot of, I don't want to say politics involved, but how many permanent job openings do we have? How many people are retiring, that kind of thing, you know, to backfill? So that's
personnel management has been a fine art, I take it.
Yes, exactly.
Bury it under one phrase.
Yeah. So yeah. It's actually just very recently that we've, because we have a big glut of people that are in my age range and within the next 5 years that are going to be retiring, that finally we've realized that, yes, we have to start hiring young people again.
Yes.
I think prior to 2 years ago was when we first started hiring new people right out of university and, you know, promoting it as a career that you could advance in the government.
Sure.
And prior to that, I don't think we had hired anyone, I bet you 10, 15 years.
Well, I'm guessing that the decline of the grade trade, which as around 84 or 5, will have had just this impact. There wasn't a need to increase the staff.
Exactly.
In fact, question would be maintaining positions, I suppose.
Exactly, because if you recall the number of grain elevators we used to have.
Yes.
We'd have staff at every single elevator, so not only staff for the cars coming in, but you also had what we call the outward gang crew. That would be the vessels. So that was an extra two or three people, plus the people on the boat.
Yes.
You know, so your outward crew would be maybe three people, PI1s actually. Assistant grain inspectors plus the inspector in charge. So that would be four people just for the boats.
Right.
And at that time, you'd get them very regularly, every day.
Yes.
You'd almost have a boat. And then plus your inward crew. So that might be another six, seven people.
At an elevator.
At an elevator, So, and that's.
Yeah, that if there were 10, 15, 20 elevators.
Exactly, yeah. So I think we had at one time just inspection, I believe we had 180, 160 people. It was huge when I first came on. Yeah. And now we're down to 50.
So every time an elevator closed, it'd be a matter of distributing the people, the inspectors who work there into the rest of the workforce.
Yeah. Although, with automation and everything else we've had, it reduces. But then in some aspects, you're gaining because now the automation means you're not out in the plant, but you still have to do, there's more things that you do in the office.
Yes. How did the automation advance? What were the things that were done? What kinds of machinery were brought in to change the way in which inspection was carried out?
Well, you had the samplers now would come into the office, so it was more of a pneumatic sampling system. It took a while, but we actually became very consistent in the types of samplers that the elevators had to have before they would be responsible for their own. They would have the old bucket and chain kind of thing, and now they have to have a certain type of sampler and pneumatic system of delivery, so the samples all come right into our office now.
So they're moved by air, sucked in an effector or whatever.
Yeah.
This is equipment that is sold by someone or other. There's a company out there that is everyone required to buy from the same company?
Then? I don't think so. No. It depends on.
But they,
I guess,
have to meet a specific.
Specific
required
criteria.
Quality.
And we test them, and we have to give the okay that they pass our tests, and then they're good to go.
So that was one part of automation, but there were other parts as well, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the same thing happened on the outward side. So whereas before it would stand on the deck of the boat. And now they put in these sampling systems that collect the sample in the elevator, and it goes through the same pneumatic system and comes into our office. So now instead of on the boat, you're just standing in front of a screen with a bucket, and you see the grain come in.
Do you think that it does a better job of the actual sampling?
We were very resistant to
You could never beat a human being doing this by eye and by hand, eh?
Well, because, say for the inward cars, when you unload a car, we would actually be in the car shed, so
yeah.
We would be writing down the car numbers, because the car is right in front of you, so you would write down the rail car number, and you'd see the grain actually coming out, whereas once we're removed from that, we're relying on, you know, say they missed a car in between, and, you know, we don't catch it because someone doesn't tell us or whatever, now all our samples are out of order, or, you know, there was things that happened like that. You know, everything worked out. We worked out all the bugs. Right? But, yeah.
Yes, I can certainly understand uncertainty, uneasiness about
exactly,
the sampling of those.
Yeah, because you're losing your sight. You're losing your confirmation. That's what we were doing, because we were confirming.
So you now did become much more dependent on the companies, the workforce of each of the elevator companies.
Exactly. Although we do have another, the other component of the Grain Commission is the weighing division. And they still have people in the car shed, because they still write down numbers, and so they would be now our eyes checking things out. Yeah. So, you know, we're kind of working together.
So the commission we've been discussing until a moment ago, simply in terms of grain inspection, as you're saying, that there was another section that was involved with weighing. Were there additional sections, or were those the two components of the commission? Staff here
we would have the inspection and weighing were the two biggest ones. Then we had another department that was part of inspection called entomology, and then they're the ones that would look for infestation,
right, on the little insects,
inward cars and vessels going out,
right,
because we're very stringent. Canada's very stringent rules about insects.
Yes. Infestations, these could be living things, I guess, could they?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certain types of bugs that will eat grain, and different conditions that will cause them. So they only could start on the prairies when there's high moisture conditions or hot weather or whatever.
Right.
And generally here in Thunder Bay, the cold weather, you have to have a spell of cold weather. It basically kills everything.
Another good reason for winter storage of grain. Eh?
That's right. And then we had another part of the Grain Commission here in Thunder Bay was our protein lab, which was they check all the grain going out, red spring wheat, for protein levels, and they would be responsible for the machines that we do the protein testing on at the elevators, and then we have our backup support admin staff.
The protein would be important to the. The customer was being promised a certain level of protein, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
What's the relationship to the wheat board? You had described the wheat board before as agent for the customer, or did you use that phrase, or something of that sort? Obviously the wheat board, well, I better not say obviously, it's for you to say.
we're not part of the wheat board.
No.
People would get us confused, but the wheat board is the buying and selling agent for the farmers, basically.
Yes.
And they also, I don't want to say dig up customers, but they advocate for the farmers, and they will go out and seek customers.
Yes.
So they're the ones that are out there promoting Canadian grain to customers.
Sure.
Yeah.
The grain companies were in the transportation and storage and service, business cleaning, I suppose, functions of those sorts. But.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't own the grain, did they? They just provided the, or could they own some? Would they own some of it, conceivably?
Not wheat board grain. So wheat board grain is owned by the wheat board. Basically, they purchase it from the farmer. They're the farmers. But they would say feed grain, or stuff like that. They would. Patterson say would have an elevator out, somewhere in the prairies. They would purchase. Feed grain or whatever, and move it to a Patterson elevator here that would go on a Patterson boat when we had Patterson elevators.
Yes. Yeah, it was being knocked down just before you began work, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I moved to town in 78, and one of the shocks was seeing the Patterson elevator on the cam come down.
Yeah.
Because my father sold all of his grain for during the years I was growing up to Patterson's in Kelross, Manitoba.
Right,
so I'm
yeah.
keenly so aware of Patterson's.
They still have, I believe they still have elevators.
Yes, they do. Oh, yeah. Yes, they have a big throughput elevator somewhere in that area, so just down the road, so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other parts of automation, the grading function itself, has that been automated as well, or does that still remain high in mind?
Yeah, they're trying to replicate the human eye, I guess, so that you could, I mean, the ideal is to pass the grain through some kind of a
sensors
filter
or
sensor, exactly, that would sense the condition of the grain and any
yeah.
defects in it or whatever, and then
yeah.
give you a grade at the other end. But, I mean, I've heard that talk for at least 25 years, and I haven't seen anything that comes close to it.
So the poor, humble, well-trained human being is what we want here.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So you've enjoyed the training function, I expect. If you had been a grain inspector as such, what would your day be like? Or what was the day like of those you watched doing the job?
Well, I was a PI3, so I was a grain inspector, I passed all the exams, of
yeah.
course, so I was an actual grain inspector on the waterfront for, I guess, maybe three or four years. So it's a kind of a routine type of day because you're tied to the unloads coming in. So your day would begin where, I don't want to say you have coffee, but...
Lots of good days start with coffee, I find. Speaking as a tea drinker myself, but conceding the fact.
But there's certain things that you have to get set up, you know, right off the bat, and the order of the cars and everything else, and you want to make sure everything, all your machinery is working and functioning and all
yeah.
that stuff. And then once the cars start coming in, then it's just a matter of you're doing the grading and doing your analysis of the car.
You see, you might receive one of these bags. Well, this is from the cars now rather than
right.
the ships. But
so you would get, so everything's automated now, so through the pneumatic system.
Yeah.
So if, say, Viterra C can unload three cars at a time, there'd be three rail lines coming in, and then three what we call receivers, and then you'd have three sampling units that would come into your
yes.
office. So you'd
yes.
have three buckets there with little tags that tell you the car that's unloading. We're not quite to the point where we have TV screens into the car shed, but so you would just wait for the sample. You get beeps and lights and everything else to tell you when the sample's all finished. And then you pull your sample and then you start your analysis.
Actually, closed circuit television would have made good sense.
Yeah.
Was it too expensive? Or?
I'm not sure, like, who would have been responsible to put that in. I know at Cargill they have a closed circuit TV so that you can see the grain being loaded onto the vessel because
sure.
where our office is and where
you're some distance
the boat's
away.
Tied up. Yeah, you're
yeah.
a little bit. It's a little awkward to see.
Yes.
So, they're the only ones that have that.
Yeah, it certainly yeah. make good sense, so that you would have your eyes
exactly
on the work being done.
Yeah, and you could actually see the car number, you know,
right.
the car coming up.
So you'd have a sample from a car, and what do you do with it?
Well, you first of all, you have to look at it and decide: is it you're going to break it down into a number of workable amount that you're going to do the analysis on. Because when you get it, it's like a big pile of grain. Because you
yeah.
get, say, 10,000 grams from a sample, you have a big pile there. So you have to divide it down. Everything we do now is very consistent and right across the country. So
sure.
we all have procedures that we do
yeah.
that we do here, that you do in Vancouver.
Well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
The ability to replicate.
Exactly.
Standards
so
applied.
The equipment that we use is all tested, and because we're also under ISO or ISQMS.
Yes, international standard organization.
Yeah,
ISOs.
So we have standards that we have to keep up, and everything
yes.
is certified and all that. So we would take the sample and divide it down to a workable size. Yeah, between about 900 to 1,000 grams. And then we would do our analysis on that sample. So then I would start looking, does the dockage material look, does it look like it has dockage, first of all?
Yeah.
If not, then I would do some shaking to see what comes through, what stays on top, and then foreign material, like rocks, stones, ergots, mercury, anything contaminating the grain that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And then I would take smaller portions of that, say a size of about maybe 100 grams, so about this big, and go through it, not kernel by kernel, but almost kernel by kernel.
For the eye, it was probably kernel by kernel, for the finger. Yeah.
Because you're looking for something that isn't uniform, that is sticking out from that sample, that's odd. So that's when you're looking for wheats of other classes, or heated wheat, or anything that is detrimental to that grade. So then from that analysis, it may or may not, depending on the tolerances, it may or may not degrade it. But you're always looking to give the best grade, of course. And then you visually look at the grade and decide, are there environmental factors that are affecting the grain, like frost or mildew or immaturity? And that also helps determine the grade.
And at the end of it all, how long would this take on the 1,000 grams that you'd separate it out from the rest?
It depends on the sample. If it's a really good looking sample, or even one that isn't really good looking but doesn't have a lot of factors that need to be what we call pipped. So if it's just a visual assessment, it could be done in from start to finish probably in between 8 to 10 minutes. And then if it's something that you need to actually pick and go through, it could take longer, depending on some of the things we have to go into our book for because we haven't seen them before, or we have certain amounts that we have to pick for certain factors, so we have to make sure that we're doing everything exactly the same.
And the intention is always to give the farmer the very best grade that his
we're objective and we're unbiased. So it's basically whatever's in front of us, that's how we grade it. So, but you never want to start looking for things that you,
No magnifying glasses.
Yeah. you're just looking at what's in front of you and giving the grade based on that.
Right. There have been interesting cases of adulteration quite recently, evidence in canola seeds of genetically modified. You're not looking for that kind of thing.
No, because you can't tell. That's a chemical.
In fact, I wonder how the Europeans decided that there was such genetically modified seed in some of these samples.
I think it's a chemical test.
They must almost have planted them or something, or doused them with, because it's very often this is herbicide tolerance, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, the Roundup Ready canola.
Yes.
And all that, and it's. Yeah, well, I noticed a big difference with canola from when I started on the job to now. Because when I first started on the canola, you'd get all kinds of weed seeds and dockage material.
And enriched canola?
I like dockage of 10%, 12% was common, whereas now, and the weed seeds that you would get through, it was amazing. Like, 5, 6% of just weed seeds.
Yeah. Could they be cleaned out?
Oh yeah, you can clean them with canola. Was
some cost.
Yeah, you'd have the sieves, and you could pretty much get everything out.
Well, you could, but I mean industrially now.
Oh yeah, because
in terms of the whole
the elevator, their sieves would replicate our sieves.
Okay.
It's just that we're doing it by hand. They have the big machines that do all the shaking.
So what do you think has happened? Are the combines more efficient in terms of separating out the dockage?
Yeah, and the Roundup Ready canola. The genetically modified canola.
The weeds are being batted down by the Roundup.
Yeah, because at one time you would see wild mustard, for example, in canola, which you cannot clean out. And you need a microscope or a 10-power optic to see if there's any canola or wild mustard in that canola.
Because it's a very little seed.
The same size as canola.
Oh, I see.
And dark like canola, so it doesn't stand out. So there's certain characteristics that you look for between Wild Mustard and Canola.
Right.
And it's...
So that might be one of the ones that would have been very attractive to the farmers.
Yeah.
And what's the company that would have known that?
Monsanto,
yes. The infamous Monsanto.
Yes.
Would have focused that. And
Monsanto. I don't want to talk about Monsanto.
Let the record show that the witness was shaking her head with horror. Am I overdoing it?
No, I just went, I would go out west to teach at Olds College in Alberta, which was good for me because you're among people that actually grow the grain, and I would learn a lot from them.
What were you teaching? Grain inspection?
Grain inspection, yeah, at Olds College. So
which college?
Olds College in
Alberta.
Olds, Alberta,
okay.
Yeah. And it went on by probably about 10 years. They haven't had it probably the last 5 or 6 years. It just seems the jobs for that particular...
Where were the graduates going? Who was employed with the Grain Commission?
Some would come to the Grain Commission, not that many, but grain companies.
Oh, I see.
In fact, at the very beginning, it was grain companies that would send their inspectors, that sent their inspectors to the first few classes that we had.
So you had the kind of a privilege in the sense
of
creating these. And what were you going to say about instruction?
I was out there when the whole big, I think his name was Percy, I can't remember his last name, was involved with with the Monsanto schmozzle. And
yes.
The thing, like you have to sign documents, basically, signing your right to your land away that Monsanto can come on your property at any time and check to see that you're not growing.
Well, I think what struck many of us as outrageous about the suit against him was that he claimed, at least, that he had not planted any of their seed. And so if it was in his own crop, clearly it was, what's the right word? It was pollution from the neighbors. It's not
exactly
the right word, but it was transmission.
Like a cross-pollination, but... cross-contamination.
And Monsanto, I guess, wanted to resist that conclusion, which is, I guess, why they pursued it as they did. Because, of course, if that were the case, then what they had was something that was going to adulterate all the farms, all the canola growers on the prairies.
Exactly.
It would not be such a thing as organic canola be growing.
Exactly. And especially with organic crops now being such a big... niche market, you don't want any of that genetically modified stuff for sure. Yeah.
No, the Europeans for canola, the Japanese for flax, similar problems have arisen, I think, the alteration.
So now I just read saw somewhere that they've approved the first genetically modified wheat to be grown. So I know they've been growing it on test plots, but I guess for production for the general...
Farming probably have the same effect that the genes get around.
Well, I think they proved it in Mexico with the corn.
Yes, I think they did.
So I don't know how he lost the suit in Canada, but
no, he really shouldn't have.
No,
but,
I know.
The economic interests involved with all of this are very strong.
Exactly.
Monsanto writ large.
Big company, big corporation. Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Well, I guess typical days, have we encompassed most of the typical days by now?
Pretty much, yeah.
Several of them, obviously.
Yeah.
What would you like people to know about the work that you'll be doing a little while longer?
Well, it's a very important job. We're basically certifying Canadian grain for... the world, basically, because we do have a lot of, I believe our output, and don't quote me on this because I'm out of touch with those numbers, but the export, we export more than what we use domestically.
So
and our quality has always been the best in the world. That's why we keep having repeat customers.
Sure.
They come back. It's backed by science. Yes. We back up everything we do. We have... all our analysis that we use, it's all backed up, which is great. So it's not like the United States where, you basically get whatever's on the boat, and that's pretty much a customer in Canada can order a specific type of grain with a specific protein level, and they know exactly how it performs each and every time from 15 years ago to today. So it's very consistent. And
it is an astonishing achievement in its way, isn't it, in terms of a growing thing, this plants that's been achieved.
Exactly, and that's why, you know, the people that farm are so important to Canada. You know, it's just, it's, to me, it's just amazing that people go out there, or people live on the prairies and farm and do that. It's a hard job.
For the limited returns they all too often had to endure.
That's right, you know, it's just, my hats go off to them.
Right. Have you met many farmers?
Well, when I was through Olds College, a lot of the younger people that would come in through the years were from farms, families, farming families. And it was really, really, that was the best part of the job, I think.
Well, I suppose in a certain sense, my heart would still be with the farmers. In fact, I've entered into a fairly loose contact at the moment with a young man who's determined to farm with horses rather than with machinery.
Wow.
And, I mean, I think that's just
that's amazing.
An astonishing thing to undertake.
Oh, yeah.
I said to him immediately, I hope you're keeping careful records, because at some point, not that far hence, I suspect, issues of mechanical, high-cost inputs into agriculture, that kind of agriculture, will surely become more and more questionable.
Oh, for sure.
Admittedly, if you use animals, then you have to grow the feed, so
right.
immediately some part of the farmland has to be devoted to that. But if
right.
it's a matter of, if we're producing a surplus anyway, what the heck if some of the land is used to grow feed for the animals, so you don't have to buy petroleum products.
That's true. And a lot of the big farms now, I guess we're seeing the demise of the smaller farms, you know, just
for years.
Over the years with, you know, auctions and selling off of land and everything. So now the people that are farming have big tracts of land, huge tracts, and renting
sections
of land. It's
worker townships, I suspect, and so on and so forth. They're farming with these huge machines that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Amazing.
Anyway, what might interest, or what might surprise, if you could choose the question you want to answer, people most about the work that you do?
I guess that it takes such a level of technical ability to do it. You know, people don't really know what we do, so to speak. And I guess just, you know, thinking, oh, grading grain, you know, well, how hard can that be? But there is a level of visual. You need to be a visual person, basically, to be able to see things in the grain, and just that technical ability that it takes, that is learned. You know, it's not something that you can read in a book. It's a real hands-on job. That's how you learn it.
Are there competitions amongst inspectors to see who's better at it or not? Does that sort of thing happen?
Oh, yeah, because there, you know, you'll have, say, a car comes in and you just want another opinion, you know, of what it is. So you'll have call Harry over to look at it, and he might say something, but you don't agree with what he says. You just want something to back up what you're saying. So then, you know, you kind of have a little, well, you could say competition, I guess. Because then you might take that car and send it to our downtown office, where the senior inspectors will look at it, and they'll give their opinion on what it is.
It comes back and you compare notes. Well, I used to belong to a 4-H seed club many, many years ago.
Okay.
I remember more about weed identification, I think, than I do about anything resembling grain grading. I don't know that anything of that sort. Although, obviously, we would be expected to know something about the grains.
Right.
But identifying weed plants, remember more about that. But anyway, it could have a lot of fun.
And that was probably the best part of going out to Olds, was being in the farmland and actually seeing it growing. You know, whereas here, if you're in Thunder Bay and you spend your whole life in Thunder Bay, you're not really exposed to the agricultural part of it. You're seeing the product coming in.
Right. So, appreciating the challenges that the farmers face.
Yeah.
I've seen the machines, obviously, you drive by or whatever, but you made a reference to the quality of the combines, and that's a bit of a novelty for me. Do you want to say more about that? Do the combines themselves have... I know that they had a new separator. 50 years ago, there was equipment in there that was involved in dropping out wheat seeds, getting rid of stones and so on and so forth.
I think that's gotten a little more refined now. Yeah. I know with canola, it actually takes the temperature of the canola and gives you a moisture content as it's coming in off the field and into the truck, you know, and it can actually clean a lot more of the seeds out and everything. You know, they're really, really high tech, GPS and everything
else. GPS, of course, the potential of that, if you really have GPS controls on, or information on your fields, because they're assessing the yield, aren't they, in various areas of the field.
So exactly.
You can then work that into your seeding and fertilizing and whatnot the next year. It's a really sophisticated business that develops.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah.
Any other interests or surprises in here?
I can't really think of any right this minute.
What are you most proud of? The work that you've done over the years?
I think I take more pride in giving out the information that I know to groups that come through Thunder Bay, touring groups that come through Thunder Bay.
So that's one of your privileges, is it, to meet with touring groups?
Yeah.
What kind of groups do come through the city?
We'll get groups from that originate in Winnipeg through the Canadian International Grains Institute, the CIGI. They'll bring in international groups from, say, millers from Brazil, or just from all over the place. And sometimes they'll take them right across the country. So they'll go to Vancouver, they'll come to Thunder Bay, they'll visit different ports. So of course, when they're on those tours, they do come through our office. So we get to show them around.
Millers from Brazil, though, that sounds like an interesting designation. You said that with knowledge, I presume.
Well, we also have opportunities to join those CIGI groups, so as representatives of the Grain Commission. So I think I was on one, it was a Durham Millers group, and they were from South America, so they were from Brazil and Latin America. I can't remember else, that was quite a while ago, but... It's kind of nice because you're meeting with international. They were customers.
Yes, but this is partly market development, I suppose. Is that part of what CIGI's about too? Then
the institute is Canadian International CIGI. We call it. Yeah.
Yes,
they are
Canadian International Grains Institute.
Yeah, so they're promoting Canadian grain also, and they work with the customers on technology. So if say a miller in Brazil wants to set up his plant for a certain type of grain or whatever, they'll send in technicians and help them set it up.
By the time they come here, by the time you meet with them, they've already been apprised about the Canadian system, its advantages and qualities and so on.
Exactly,
I suppose.
But they learn a lot while they're here, you know, because they're seeing it firsthand now. So it's.
Do they express their satisfaction, their pleasure, their astonishment at what they're seeing?
Yeah, it's quite good. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's good.
Do you see groups, Canadian groups as well, from the prairies very often?
Or? We'll get the odd, even individual farmers will come through, producers will come through, that just happen to be going through Thunder Bay, so they'll stop.
But would they call the Grain Commission here in town and ask if they could?
Yeah, we've had that happen. Or they'll talk to, they deal mostly with Viterra.
Sure.
They'll
whatever the
contact
company.
With Viterra, and then Viterra may contact us and say, you know, we have some people here where they'd like to tour the Grain Commission. And,
So you're the tours department of the
part of the tour, yes.
for the grain companies too, that they look to you to do it, or are you part of it? I mean, they'll show them around, and then
they'll come to my department, and give them a little bit of a talk, And then I guess right now the biggest thrill for me is seeing brand new people come on and passing on my skills, so to speak, and seeing them get it.
Were you the teacher, or are there were there others as well?
In Thunder Bay, it was me. And then I would have people that would help me because it's, you know, just there's a lot of people.
Would you want to speculate on why you were chosen to do this?
Well, probably because I have a good rapport with, easygoing rapport with people. And,
right. Bright but pleasant.
Yeah.
Like she's got a door stuffed. She does that, obviously.
And probably just being able to show different aspects of the job and explaining things and being a mentor.
How many of your, could you say something about the variety of people that you've instructed over these years? How large did it become? Kennedy, we're close to gender balance, maybe that's one way of putting it, 50-50. That may not have been a goal, of course, but.
I think we're pretty close now.
So it would be reflective of the population of gender terms.
I think so, yeah.
The workforce.
Yep.
Did employment equity objectives, other objectives come into play as well?
Yeah, so we have Aboriginal people, we have Eastern.
Visible minorities, I think is the term.
Exactly.
I've worked in this area a little bit.
And it's, you know, it's good to see that diversity.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there are some Aboriginal inspectors as well, are there?
Yep. In fact, we just had a what we call a PI3 competition. We haven't had successful candidates probably in the last 3 times we've run it. And so I was getting very discouraged because just, you know, we were questioning, well, was the exam too hard or the teaching methods not good enough or were people just not applying themselves or whatever. And so this time we had 7 people pass, which was great. And it was a diverse element, which was great too.
Yeah, I guess an academic, I can certainly agonize with you over the question of the quality of the teaching, the rigor of the exam, the end result, and so
exactly.
on and so forth. These are always very difficult matters.
Well, especially because, like I said, you know, just to refer back to the going uphill to school and back, because we had to memorize everything when we did our exams, and now everything is open book. Plus,
they could flip fast enough.
Open book plus, you know, we had to actually, when we grade grain, we have what are called standards, which is the standard of quality for a certain type of grade, for a certain grade. And that's what we're always comparing grain to. So we actually had to visually memorize these standards before we wrote the exam because you had to compare it in your head. And now we actually give people the physical standard to use while they're doing the test. So, you know, we just can't.
How in the world did that ever get allowed?
I know. You know, what are we doing wrong that people can't pass these exams when, you know, but we worked it out.
When did the open book policy come
that
in?
That came in about probably 4 or 5 years ago. And when it came out, actually, we just very recently have a department in Winnipeg, that's our head office, is in Winnipeg, that oversees the training for the whole country. So before it was regionally, so I would be in charge of the training for Thunder Bay. And now with this national component, the training is all consistent. Every region has the same type of training. We follow very rigid learning plans and outcomes and all that kind of stuff, so it's good.
That would be an improvement, I suppose, over the old way,
because now we know that, you know, in Thunder Bay we're getting the same training as people in Vancouver and vice versa.
As you near the conclusion of your career here, do you have any thoughts about the way in which the Commission has functioned over the years? In such things as the possibility of regional idiosyncrasies, for example. I mean, that's the other side of what you're just describing.
Exactly.
The possibility of it.
And no doubt things did exist, you know, regionally, because just because of the type of grain that came in, or how we, you know, Thunder Bay has Lakers, whereas Vancouver would deal most of the salty. So there was always regional differences, and Montreal would be taking in corn and all things that we wouldn't see here. So there were always those regional differences that would come into play. But it's actually good now because inspectors, because it's national now, so when you do an exam, the inspector has to know corn, they have to know buckwheat, you have to know everything, you know, which is good.
Open book or
open
not.
Open book or not, exactly.
Well, I suppose if everyone had to know everything, a little help wouldn't hurt, I suppose.
True.
Yeah, good old buckwheat.
So it's been fun.
I guess I hardly have to ask you whether you think your work contributed to Canada's success in the international grain trade.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because of our very rigid, I wouldn't say rigid, but they're very
rigorous.
They are rigorous, thank you. Very rigorous standards with Canadian grain going to the customers. Like I said before, they've come to expect a certain quality.
Yes.
So Canada's, we're elevated in the world of grain quality.
Would you have seen European millers at any point in these tours?
I personally haven't, but in Winnipeg they would have, yeah.
So you understand that millers in Europe and perhaps in other places would be well aware of the high quality of what they were buying, and quite capable of mixing in some other grades in the process of achieving the bread that they wanted.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Yeah, I know Italy imports our durum.
Yes, I think they would.
Yeah, so that's a coup for Canada, really, you know, that it's such high quality and very consistent.
Yes.
And a lot of millers anywhere in Canada or in Europe, I'm sure they buy different grades of grain, and they will just, it's a recipe that they use.
Yes.
So they're not always buying the top quality, but they may blend in.
Yes, I suppose that would be the point at which to go if we had the opportunity to interview a miller. Would be the, what are the different mixes of grain that you want for the various kinds of bread you're baking?
Well, I know Warburton. I don't know if that's the name of the company in England.
Warburton.
Warburton, it's a big bakery bread place, but they would import Canadian red spring, only certain varieties, and we always called them Warburton shipments because we knew they were going right to England for their own purposes, so I know they would blend certain varieties together.
Yeah. And that would, I suppose, reflect many years of experience on their part as to what produced the right kind of bread.
Exactly.
All these multi-grain breads these days, of course, must really be a joy to put together in the bakery.
Well, we don't see, it's funny, we don't see stuff like spelt or kamut because they aren't officially Canadian, one of our 21 grains, so they're not an official grain. So we don't really see them coming through the port. I mean, they could come in containers and be shipped out, but we don't officially inspect them.
No. Oh, well, there are various grains about, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me see. Describe any connections you see between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain handled in the grain trade. Well, I think we may largely have answered that question.
I think so.
Right. Changes. There's a section on changes and another one on challenges and then significant events. What major changes did you see in your job in the trade over the years that you've worked in it?
Well, just the changes in the consistency of our own Grain Commission job across the country. So where we were all now doing exactly the same thing, whereas before, you know, it might have taken a little shortcut here or there or whatever, but now everything is very, again, rigorous, but controlled. So and it's consistent, so you're always getting a consistent result at the end. And I mean, it only makes sense that if I do an analysis in Thunder Bay, why wouldn't I get the same result if I did it in Vancouver, following the same procedures?
But that's something that was brought consciously into the policy of the Grain Commission then.
Well,
did a commissioner, the top dog as a commissioner, I guess.
I think it was just kind of evolving, maybe through ISO and stuff, because we didn't always have equipment that was tested all the time.
Right.
You know, we always have grading lights that are a certain distance from the bench, say. But maybe we didn't have, in the old days, we didn't have a certain brightness that they had to be. They had to be a certain kind of bulb, but maybe
they
didn't have to have a certain brightness. So then my bench could be darker than the one at a different elevator. They could be different levels of light. So now all that is consistent. We actually go with light meters and check everything.
Do you have knowledge of how these ISO standards were developed for the Great Commission? Were they developed in the Commission or given to it?
I'm not exactly sure. That was a head office thing, so that would have been... Yeah.
See, if our interviewers in Winnipeg get close to the...
Yeah.
Or even think of asking the question, we may have to pass that one on to them as something to ask.
Actually, my old boss, probably, he was involved in getting that whole thing started here. I don't know if you've interviewed him.
Who's that?
Jack Robertson?
I think so.
He would have been the...
add him to our list.
For the Grain Commission in Thunder Bay. So he would have been the regional manager for Thunder Bay. He was he retired maybe about 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
But he is very knowledgeable. And he would have seen those changes. And he would have been a part of them because of being his position.
Yes.
Of being head of Thunder Bay. So.
Yeah. Well, I certainly see the value of comparability in such matters as lighting of benches and so on and so forth. So you can, everyone sees it the same.
Exactly.
Of course, testing of eyes could follow on and be sure they're all equally acute.
Exactly.
I guess what does draw the line is, was your vision an issue?
We always had, actually that was one thing that was taken out and now we may be putting it back in. Where there was a requirement when I started that if you were under 30, was it 30 or 35, you only had to get your eyes tested every 7 years or something. But once you hit,
35.
I believe the magic number was 35. It could have been 40, I'm not sure. Then, or if you wore glasses originally when you were hired, then you had to have your eyes tested every 2 years or every 3 years. Or it might have even been yearly. I think it was yearly after you were 50.
Yeah.
But then in Ontario, because the health policies, like OHIP, is different from what you would have in Vancouver. So Ontario, now we could only get our eyes checked every 2 years and
have the cost covered.
Exactly. Yes. Whereas maybe in Manitoba it would be different. They could get their eyes tested every year. So I guess there was too much discrepancy. They just scrapped the whole thing. So they're thinking of bringing it back.
Someone who is short-sighted wears glasses. But not to work on the computer screen. My eyes are just fine at 18 inches or so. Anyway, better not waste time with that sort of thing. So those are some of the, you mentioned, of course, the automation earlier.
The automation
that would
be. That was a big change for us.
The change in the workforce, I suppose, is employment equity. So my memory is that employment equity being our term rather than affirmative action is about 83 or 84 when the policy changes were being contemplated. I guess they probably came into effect gradually through the later 80s.
Yeah.
And the Great Commission, too, would face the challenge of having its workforce be more reflective of the local population.
Exactly.
Was that consciously, was it addressed in those terms?
Yeah.
The Aboriginal people in the community, there should be some of the great inspectors.
Yeah, because we actually had, we would go out and recruit specifically Aboriginal people, women.
Yeah.
So it was.
Are the numbers sort of public or not? I'm just curious how many Aboriginal people there might be in the local workforce now.
Well, because that would be a, what do you call it, voluntary?
Yeah, it's self-identification, I think, is the Canadian policy.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if that would be public or not.
Well, I remember being a dozen years ago chairing the Indigenous Learning Department here for a year, acting chair. At a meeting of an advisory committee, someone said something about it. There are more Aboriginal people on the students on the campus these days than the number of the Aboriginal people around the room are almost simultaneously. How do you know? I thought to myself, of course, they don't always look all those blue-eyed, blonde, Aboriginal people.
Exactly.
And the impact that these changes had on your job and the industry, I suppose maybe you want to add anything to what you said about these changes?
No, just I'd say probably we're getting away with, we used to rely on the book, I guess, is basically a book.
Well, if it's open book, they still do.
Well, no, but because everything is now on the computer and you can access it through the computer. The computer is now part of your workstation and you access the grading guide through a PDF file on the computer.
Sure.
But it's just not the same as opening a book.
The Atlantic Monthly cover, is the internet making us stupid?
You have to turn that page, you know, to know what was before it and what was after it. You know,
right.
It's just that physical,
I quite agree.
thing of turning the pages and
So there are these feelings amongst the senior grade inspectors.
That was a big struggle, especially when we had probably about 10 years ago, it was probably 15 years ago when we started with, we had old apples, really old. Like the original.
We're talking about Macintosh computers and things of that sort, are we?
Yeah. The old, they were about this big.
Yeah.
And they were.
Well, the Mac Pluses and whatnot, and the classics and so on through the 90s.
Yeah, and those were the first things we used.
I bought my first Mac Plus in January of 89, more than 20 years ago.
Yeah, so these were probably, they would be around that time that we, that was our first computer, and trying to get, you know, senior inspectors who had been in the war, you know, and were just about to retire, trying to get them to actually type instead of writing things out. That was a big, big challenge. Yeah.
Well, the old dogs can learn new tricks when they're two-legged dogs. I've discovered. Like I'm astonished. I never learned to type, but I'm astonished at how well I word process these days.
Okay. Yeah.
The fingers have learned that over the 20 years of doing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I've not had any instruction at all. I'm sort of. Play there with the fingers, and it's not orthodox entirely, I'm sure, but I am using most of the fingers.
That's good.
And processing.
Yeah. It was that initial resistance, I guess, to the big change. It was a big change.
Yeah.
There was a lot of resistance.
To my brother, electrical engineer in Winnipeg, I guess depended on staff, as I did, of course, as member of parliament in the mid. Through the mid-80s, those 4 years, the staff did all of this, but when I was defeated and came back to the university, that's when I bought my Mac Plus, and he was learning computer from a daughter, actually, because he hadn't actually used one over all those years to his retirement in the 90s, which just kind of blew me away, because you figure engineers are into this kind of stuff.
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, I'm wasting time. Besides dealing with change, what other challenges have you faced on the job over the years? Harassment?
Well, when I first started, because I was one of just a few women that were on the job. So you had to be pretty tough, thick-skinned, I guess.
People said things.
Yeah, and not from, say, grain commission people, but when you were working in the plant with elevator people.
Yeah, the grain handlers and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, because they were definitely not enlightened at all. Some of them.
You better not get into characterizing them here.
I can't say all, but I'll say some. There was, you're always going to, in such a big population, you're going to get a few that are going to stand out. So that was probably.
There were those who did it briefly, but you've remained with it. Your working years, and you're pleased to have done it, I expect.
Yeah, it was a good job. I think because I was able to progress through the through promotions and stuff, and I wasn't always kept at one level.
No.
Whether by choice or not, But I was given. There were opportunities for advancement, which I think really helped.
And when you say that you had to be thick-skinned in terms of surrounding workforce, the workforce, your fellow inspectors were more respectful of the fact that change was taking place and,
I think,
accepting of it.
Yeah, like, you know, there were things that, with the advent of women on the job, that we definitely addressed, you know, like the new calendars on the walls. You know, you'd see them everywhere, and then they were gone, yeah. You know, after we brought it to light. And,
yes.
You know, and then you had women's, with the union, you had a women's group that were specifically working for women in the union.
Right.
And, you know, that was new, and stuff like that.
Your union was the...
Public,
or
PSAC.
Is the part of the Public Service Alliance,
yeah.
Of Canada,
yeah.
a section of it, is it?
Exactly.
And so you were the beneficiary of the Women's Committee of the Public Service Alliance,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Not anymore. I haven't been. I'm out of the union
right.
with my current job.
How long have you been out of the union?
20 years.
Oh, it's from the time you became
an
instructor, you were
just
training.
My job classification
right.
took me out.
Right. No, you hadn't been such a... A pushy union type that they promoted you up, I don't suppose, or have you?
Well, I did have a few grievances in my day, but yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think they do.
Many a workplace in which the able union person does get promoted to supervisory staff, I'm not sure that that's designed to end grievances. It's that there's ability and energy being shown.
Yeah, sure enough.
The management gets the advantage of it.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
But it does have that silver lining, I suppose. Oh, what a thought! What major challenges do you think that the grain industry has faced over the years that you've been aware of?
Well, I think this whole basically the free trade thing really. Kind of opened things up, and that's when I saw the port starting to decline.
So the FTA in 89, and the NAFTA following
that.
On that.
Yeah,
so,
I think it was even before that.
Or the Western Grain Transportation Act?
When that, all those things sort of started falling,
right.
You could see it just, that was going to be the end, beginning of the end.
So
but the Crows passed the Crows rates.
Well, yes, I was just going to say, as a historian, Prairie Roots, I guess. I could think of knowledge of the Lakehead. I could say that there was perhaps a century, a glorious century of the grain trade from perhaps the first CPR train from the prairies in 1883 through Western Grain Transportation Act taking effect just about that time, 1983-84.
Yep.
It's almost exactly 100 years, and then changes began to take place.
Yep.
And those have been there as a challenge through the last 25 years.
And I remember one of the old grain inspectors, who was my boss at the time, and I think it was just during the time with the free trade when Mulroney was in power and all that.
Yeah.
And I remember him standing up in the lunchroom and saying, "This is the end of the Grain Commission," he said.
Of the Grain Commission.
The Grain Commission is going downhill from this day on. And actually, in terms of shipments, number of staff, elevator closures,
yeah, there's much truth in that observation.
Yeah, yeah.
The commission has survived to the present day, although I understand that it may be under attack these days.
It seems like we've always been under scrutiny from Parliament or the elevator companies or someone.
Sure.
Just because of the nature of our job.
Yeah, scrutiny is one thing, and certainly the trade, people in the trade will watch inspectors like hawks, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the inspectors are watching them like hawks. At the workbench level, so to speak, the inspection bench, what have relations with the grain company people been like?
Oh, no, it's been...
Amicable enough?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Because you work with, you see them every day also. So
yes.
It's not, there's no butting of heads or anything like that. That all happens at the higher levels.
Yes. Do you share coffee rooms?
No.
So there's no fraternization with the enemy. Isn't quite the right phrase, but and yet there may be hints of it. You have your own coffee, lunch facilities, and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, because we are on their property.
Right.
So, you know, you might still go down to the lunchroom together.
Yes.
Chocolate bar or something like that. Yeah, we don't really
and their lunchroom might not be as affected by employment equity.
This is true.
Activity as yours.
This is true.
Yeah, I can imagine. How are these challenges met? People still sure on?
challenges of, I can't remember what I said.
Well, I guess the decline of the grain trade in a sense over the last quarter century here.
Well, that in Thunder Bay it translated to we weren't hiring new staff.
No.
So, in fact, we had a couple of instances where we downsized staff, full-time staff, because of elevators closing or reorganization of the Grain Commission from larger staffs, just them saying, well, you can do the job with X number of people instead of 10, you know, you can do it with 4 or something like that. So, things that were out of our control.
Right. What are your most vivid memories about the job?
Just the people that I've worked with and having a lot of laughs. We have such a diverse group, personality-wise. And it was...
Is there much socializing amongst the inspectors?
Yeah,
Christmas
actually,
party or...?
We used to, when I first came on the job, because when I first came on the job, there was a bunch of us that were very young, that were all hired together. So we kind of moved up the seniority thing.
Kind of a cohort that hung together. Right?
So we had Christmas parties. We had a baseball team. What else did we do? I think picnics, summer picnics for the kids and all that.
Was it the cohort that was doing this or the entire?
No, the cohort group that we would do all this stuff. And then once we got, there was an era, maybe about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where because of the downsizing and the turmoil and, the scrutiny on the Grain Commission, were we going to be eliminated totally and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of, I don't know how to say it, just turmoil, or people didn't really want to be socializing anymore. It was more, you go to work and all you'd hear was bitching and complaining, and so that sort of took over.
Morale would have suffered through those
years,
eh?
Exactly. And that kind of, we're slowly getting out of it now, and now with this advent of the last 2 years hiring new, young, vibrant people, it just lifted us up, and it actually makes me really happy because you see them now organizing social things and doing things together, and I think, oh, yay, there's hope for the Grain Commission.
it's tough for an institution to endure for a time without additions to it. It can be stultifying, it can be...
Because you're spending so much time with everyone. Yeah. It's 8 hours plus overtime. A lot of times you might work overtime every night. And 5 days a week, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week, you're spending with this group of people. So.
Right. That lovely French phrase, esprit de corps, I suppose that would be true for inspectors. You know your skills. You appreciate your superiority over other parts of humanity and so on and so forth. Or am I wrong?
kind of.
For some of that.
Yeah.
I can well imagine.
Yeah.
The skills and concern that it may not be there to the same level these days and so on and so forth, yes.
True.
Always tell the older ones in the room. You think it's important for us to be preserving and sharing the history of the grain trade as we're endeavoring to do by sort of plumbing your memory this afternoon?
I think it's great. I think it's very worthwhile, very worthwhile. Especially as things change here in Thunder Bay and we kind of lose sight of, how great this waterfront was at one time or how vibrant it was with the number of elevators.
Right.
How many there were, 30 or whatever, the trains coming through, the boats, the ships coming through. And I think we need to
capture it while we can.
Exactly.
Capture that great century and the years that followed on afterwards. Do you have any sense of aspects of the history that we should really concentrate on preserving?
No, I think if you're doing like an overview of everything, I think
catch
that's,
everyone.
Yeah.
Right. There's another question about any other questions that you think I might have asked you. This is where we have learned to bring our chief engineer in, who may has been listening quietly for quite a long period of time, and is probably agog with questions of his own. But you want to lead on?
I suppose we didn't plan on becoming a great inspector.
No.
And this
just
happened.
True.
So, what had you seen your life offering you when you were 25 before you got into this?
Well, oh, I was an aspiring artist, you see, and
I understand that you may be continuing.
I am. I'm looking at that 30-year break, and now I'm continuing on. No, and I had worked for actually. Chapels in the window department.
Which episode?
I was part-time working there, making, I believe it was $3.25 an hour. And just part-time. And I had just, we had recently gotten married, and then this job came up, and it was paying, I think, $8 at the time. And it was like, okay, big decision here.
Easy to make, I think.
Easy to make, yes. And that was it. That was, once I got on, that was, the money was good, the people were good.
What media do you work in?
I'm a painter.
A painter?
Yeah.
Any paintings that reflect your work or that relate to the Great Trip?
Just trying to think. I've recently gone back, well, starting in 2000, finished my degree here in
visual arts.
Yeah, which I started back in 1972, I believe, when the first visual arts program opened here. I can't say no, because when I'm an abstract painter now, when I go out to the prairies for the job, and I was just out there recently, and it was harvest time, so everything, the picture I had in my head of the gold harvest with that huge, beautiful blue sky, see, that gives me a lot of impressions that I put back into my paintings.
Sure.
Yeah, it does. Not specifically
no.
Detailed landscape, but yeah.
So how did the job, and at one point, answer that, I'll give you my reasons for asking this after the interview, but how did it change you as a person at that point?
When I first started, or
and
all
looking
through
back.
The years? Well, it's given me more opportunities for, because also being a government job, you're also involved in different courses for goal setting and conflict resolution and acquiring different skills that I probably wouldn't have gotten if I had stayed with chapels, So that has allowed me to expand my repertoire, I guess, of people skills, so to speak. So that's always a good thing.
Are there any other questions we might have asked that come to mind? Which comes down, I guess, are there aspects of your work life that we didn't think about up to this point?
I think you've covered quite a range of things. Yeah, I guess I'm just sorry to see a lot of the technical aspects the skills that we had that separated us from other countries, say the US or Australia or whatever.
Yes.
Very technical skills like varieties and all that kind of stuff just kind of be gone because of government policies like privatization or opening up, restricting scientists too much so they can't make new breeds of wheat
Yes.
You know, so it's affecting us and our skills.
What do you think is driving that on? So obviously be inferential, sort of a gut sense or whatever. You said policy, of course. Why, it hasn't been entirely peculiar to the present conservative government, I suppose. Was it happening earlier under the Liberals, too?
It probably started then, or even before that, where because of restrictions, so because of the restrictions of varietal distinguishability, you know, the visual distinguishability,
right.
That was the biggest single restriction that what I see as the wheat scientists had against them. So it restricted them from, say, producing a type of wheat that was resistant to midge damage or something else. It took them too long to...
Well, do you think some of it came from the plant scientists themselves?
Oh,
that
for sure. Oh, yeah.
The plant breeders said, we just can't continue this.
Yeah, too many restrictions.
That excellent article in Equinox, if the plant breeder is still alive, it'd be fun to talk to him about it.
Was that the one about the wheat?
Yes. Yeah, it must be 20 years ago now, that article.
That
it was a marvelous account of what went into breeding new varieties of wheat. Yes, it does take years and years of effort.
Yeah, so I think they wanted to see it shortened, and you know, so they could get the varieties out in a shorter time. But that, again, that kind of reduces our skills.
Isn't necessarily progress.
Exactly.
Speaking somewhere between the historian and the politician and whatnot.
And I guess the next step will be when they actually do come up with that machine that will, you know, you put the grain under and it scans it and does away with the human computer.
Well, there are skeptics out there, aren't there? I think Sir Roger Penrose is the great British mathematician who thinks artificial intelligence, I think, is an oxymoron. It won't be achieved. I've got a copy of his, I think, the theory, the approach to reality. It's a nice fat book. It must have 600 pages in it. More mathematics than I will ever master. But he has the right kind of skepticism about things, too. Well, that pretty well concludes it. There's another question about memorabilia that you might have to share and about other people to interview, but I don't think we need to put that onto the... So we'll ask Owen to wrap it up. With thanks to you for having given us, I think, a very interesting interview.
That was very interesting, yes.
Quite enjoyed this.